We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's, no local today for our
No, it's been a really slow couple of weeks for local news.
All right.
Except for the, you know, special session of the state legislature and the ongoing debate over how many and how much their aggressive taxes will rise at the expense of, you know, not doing anything about tax loopholes and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But frankly, we talk about that every week, so we don't need to talk about it this week.
All right. Well, let's move on to the subject that the corporate media appears to be mentioning more than anything else, and that's the upcoming healthcare vote.
Yeah, and they're mentioning it for a good reason. It's a very important vote. Will almost certainly happen this weekend, and the Democratic leadership in Congress, and particularly in the House, is desperately trying to wrangle the 216 votes that would be necessary to pass healthcare reform. And it really is a no-win situation at this point, because the healthcare bill, I think even its strongest proponents would probably acknowledge, at least privately, that it's, you know, not anything close to an ideal bill. It's not going to solve a lot of problems. It certainly creates a lot of problems, particularly around issues like restricting reproductive freedoms and the fact that it's a massive giveaway for insurance and pharmaceutical companies. The flip side of that is that if this fails, you've got a couple of things going on. One is that Congress almost certainly won't attempt any other kind of health care reform for some time to come. The second piece of that is that it is widely expected that if this fails, that it will be very difficult for Barack Obama to get anything else accomplished. And the likely anti-incumbent vote that's shaping up to happen this coming November is likely to be that much more pronounced because of the meme that even with a supermajority, the Democrats can't get anything done. So, you know, you've got two choices, either an imperfect bill that will help some people and hurt others, the status quo, which is extremely destructive, and the chances that, the Republican Party, which at this point seems to have taken as a lesson from the failed Bush presidency that they weren't nearly radical enough, those folks being back in power in a few months. And, either option is not a very good one. That scenario, the prospect of severely impairing the Obama presidency is apparently what prompted Dennis Kucinich to reverse course and come out in support of the health care bill this past week. The other thing that that he and other backers have pointed to is the Congressional Budget Office estimate that the health care bill would save $1.3 trillion in health care costs in the economy over the coming 20 years. Of course, a lot of that is backloaded because many of the reforms don't actually take effect for several years, which is part of the giveaway, of course, to insurance and pharmaceutical companies, that they get a chance to gouge people for that many more years before the minimal reforms that do take effect.
To raise rates by 30 to 50 or
60%.
Yeah.
It really is pretty abominable all the way around. But that is the choice that we're left with, to do nothing or do something very, 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 very much that is very much not what is needed. And it really does point out something that I think a lot of people across the political spectrum and with their own, you know, sets of information and their own ideological filters are coming to the same conclusion, which is that our political system is very, very, very broken and really can't cope with a lot of the pressing problems of our times. And if it can't do that around healthcare, how are we going to cope with something like climate change?
Yeah, and I think what this really points out, too, when I'm looking at particularly at this House bill, how, the first version passed by the House had an option for a government-sponsored plan, and this one doesn't. And what's interesting to me is that in order to get this bill drafted, the Democrats made concessions to the Republicans and the conservatives in their own party at the expense of the more liberal wing of their party, who's, you know, now deciding, many of them deciding not to vote for this bill. And now they have to go to the blue dog Democrats, the conservative Democrats, and try to win them over and get them to vote for it. It just really points out, I think, that as the Republican Party has gotten more right wing and more radical, that the Democrats have really moved to the right more and become really the conservative party that the Republicans used to be 40 years ago. And it really, I think, points out the flaws in our two-party system. We need multiple parties. We need more parties. We need, and really a multi-party system is what most democracies in the developed world have. And we're unique in that we only have this two-party system.
And a two-party system that does not represent the views of the vast majority of the American public.
Exactly.
All right. Anything else on healthcare?
Oh, I'm sure we'll be talking about it again.
Yeah. All right. Well, moving on, talk about mercury emissions.
Yeah, a group called the Environmental Integrity Project came out with a report this week detailing that mercury emissions, which are not regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, increased at 27 of the top 50 coal-fired power plants in the United States from 2007 to 2008, which not coincidentally was the last year of the Bush administration. Coal plants are responsible for some 40% of U.S. mercury emissions, and as most people know, mercury is an extremely toxic metal that gets into tissue. It gets into brain tissue. It can cause brain damage. And, not coincidentally, 5 of the 10 worst power plants are in the state of Texas, which might explain the endemic brain damage for people from the state of Texas. Since 1990, the EPA has been required under the Clean Air Act to impose controls on mercury, but there's still no national regulation around that. The EPA has said that they're working on a mercury reduction rule for power plants that they've agreed in a court settlement to complete by November 2011, which is another year and a half off. The EPA did adopt a cap and trade scheme under the Bush administration in 2005, that being, the sort of tradable mercury emission allowances that, Obama is now trying to do with climate change. But a federal court ruled that it didn't comply with the Clean Air Law and threw it out a couple of years ago.
Probably because there's no safe level of mercury.
Well, there's no safe level of mercury, number one, and cap and trade doesn't reduce the overall emissions. It just moves them around.
Exactly.
Which is also why cap and trade doesn't work very well for climate change, because frankly
the Earth's
atmosphere doesn't really care where the greenhouse gas emissions come from. It's just the overall amount that makes a difference.
No, and it's interesting. I mean, you were saying too that didn't the EPA say that they, weren't you telling me that the EPA hasn't come out with any sort of limit for mercury emissions?
Well, there is no safe limit, as you said.
Yeah, that's right. There's no
safe
limit
for usually, neurotoxin. But usually with heavy metals and in particulate matter like this, they will come out with some sort of a standard, mm-hmm. even for voluntary compliance. And,
right.
and again, particularly during the Bush administration, but also all during the Clinton years. Because remember, this was, the Clean Air Act passed in 1990 under Bush Sr. Mm-hmm. They haven't done this yet. And some of that is changing science because mercury is now understood to be much more toxic than people understood 20 years ago. But nonetheless, it's really inexcusable that it hasn't happened so far.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, some interesting stuff this week. Senator Chris Dodd, produced a revised financial reform bill on Monday, and it would do a number of things. It would set up a 9-member council to watch for systemic risks. It would also change the role of the Fed. This is one of the controversial aspects of the bill. The Fed would not oversee all banks anymore. It would only oversee the biggest banks, which has been a source of protest at the Fed. They don't want to lose any of their regulatory powers, even though, as many senators have pointed out to them, you guys didn't exactly exercise much in the way of regulatory powers prior to the financial collapse.
And technically speaking, it's not even a government agency. It's a private agency.
I know. And then, they were trying to take, and this bill would take steps to change that. considerably. It would make the Fed it would add more government government oversight to the Fed, including allowing the president to appoint the Fed chief himself, which is not the way it's done now. It would also remove some of the control that the financial industry has over the Fed. So in that way, the bill is good. It would also set up a $50 billion fund to bail out big banks, which is one of the responses to the whole taxpayer anger over the big bailout of these enormous banks in late 2008 and early 2009, all the money that was poured into rescuing them. But what I found interesting looking at this bill is some of the changes that were made were ones that were proposed by the Obama administration, including adding in the Volcker Rule, which would ban large banks from doing their own proprietary trading, something that the banking industry and the banking lobbyists have been really unhappy about. They don't want to see anything like the Volcker Rule get passed. But it also weakens the bill in many other ways. And what I find interesting in this debate of what parts of the bill are good and what parts of the bill are bad and how this is going to impact the industry is that most of the stuff in this bill would be completely unnecessary if the Senate and the House would just sit down and reinstitute Glass-Steagall.
Remind people what Glass-Steagall is?
Yeah, what Glass-Steagall was it was passed in the wake of the Great Depression. What it did was it said that no commercial bank, that is banks that are brick and mortar banks that take your deposits and set up checking accounts for people, et cetera, no commercial bank would be able to own or run an investment bank. No investment bank could run a commercial bank. No, you know, neither of these two types of banks could own an insurance company, et cetera. It set up these walls in the financial system that said that these different types of financial companies had to be separate companies and they couldn't all be done under one house with one set management team. And it limited the size that financial companies could get. So if they reinstituted Glass-Steagall, that would remove a lot of the need to pass these types of laws. And you wouldn't have these companies get so big that if one failed, it could bring down the whole financial system. So if they just could do that, it would help considerably. However, the one argument that is made by the banking industry, by the financial industry and banking lobbyists is that you can't reinstitute Glass-Steagall, you can't limit the size of banks because then that would limit the growth of companies. Large companies need somewhere to go in order to borrow large amounts of money to do things like, you know, finance mergers and corporate takeovers and you know, set up new business units in foreign countries. Like if, for example, a big company wants to go and open up a new arm in China, they need a lot of money. They need to borrow a big chunk of money to do that. And to be able to borrow that big chunk of money, they may do a couple of things. They may do a bond issue where they sell bonds on the credit markets, but that won't bring in quite enough money. They may need to go to a big bank and get a really, really big loan to get started. Well, the answer to that is, gosh, what did we do before, you know, when we had to operate under Glass-Steagall? Well, companies grew, but they grew at a much slower rate. And when they needed a lot of money, they either saved money or they went to a lot of different banks and they put together a financing plan. And each of those banks looked very carefully at the financing plan and they looked very carefully at the credit worthiness of the company. And they were much more conservative in who they loaned money to, which overall is better for the financial industry. So this argument that you can't reinstitute Glass-Steagall because it would limit the size of banks and therefore they couldn't make these big loans is actually a phony argument, one that introduces a huge amount of risk into the system. And what really reinforces that is that recently economists have been talking about another problem that we're heading into as we get closer to 2012. It's called a debt maturity wall. Evidently, a lot of big companies sort of went through this orgy of borrowing huge amounts of money from these big banks in 2006, 2007, and 2008. Usually those debts need to be rolled over in about 5 to 7 years. That means starting in 2012, a huge amount of corporate debt is going to become due. It's going to have to be refinanced. So if you look at 2009, about $21 billion in junk bonds is going to have to be refinanced. But come 2012, that's going to go up to about $155 billion. 2013, it's going to be about $212 billion. And by 2014, the estimate is about $338 billion. That's just corporate junk bonds, so lower-rated corporate debt. When we get to 2012, the higher-rated corporate debt is going to be about $526 billion. You add that all up, and you add in the fact that the U.S. government is going to have to borrow between $1.2 and $1.4 trillion in the same year.
And a lot of commercial real estate mortgages are coming due.
Oh, yeah, although that's a smaller chunk. That's closer to about $60 billion. But still, you add all that together, and it's coming together to look like a perfect storm on the credit markets, something that could really tank the economy if companies can't get their act together and refinance before then. Of course, right now is not a great time to refinance because the big banks are holding on to their cash. They're not willing to lend. So
Now explain something to me, because I think I missed something here.
Uh-huh.
The whole argument about not reinstating Glass-Steagall is mm-hmm. because big banks would then be unable to borrow the money that they need to borrow in order to grow.
Big companies, yeah.
Big companies, mm-hmm. yeah. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
So, but isn't the whole point of reinstating Glass-Steagall that having big companies grow further is a bad idea?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't see that as a bad idea. They think the bigger companies get, the better. I mean, that's good for growth, for the economy, right?
Wouldn't the proper response to, big companies can't grow further because they can't borrow the money is, we don't call that a bug, we call that a design feature.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at how the economy has grown in the last 10 to 20 years, you find that a lot of companies have grown by buying out other companies. And in order to do that, usually they have to borrow money. And that's one of the things that would slow way down if they reinstituted Glass-Steagall. And as Jobs said, that's not necessarily a bad idea. You know, depending on your viewpoint. And I think you're absolutely right that that's not necessarily a bad idea for companies to grow a little bit more slowly or for them to grow in an old-fashioned way. You grow by getting more customers, by making more sales, not by simply taking over your rival and running up a huge amount of debt.
Moving on then to international, and let's start with Iraq.
Yeah, while we were away last week, Iraq had its second parliamentary elections of the post-invasion and occupation era, and the responses to those, the returns from those elections are incomplete so far. It's going to take several weeks to have final tallies for the elections, but what we do know so far from the incomplete returns is several fairly interesting things. One is that the Iraqi political landscape, even within the sectarian blocks of Shiite and Sunni and Kurd, seem to be fracturing quite a bit. For instance, in the Shiite camp, you have rather than al-Maliki, he was, at least in the incomplete returns, narrowly leading but not with enough votes in himself in order to form a new government, and there is significant opposition to continuing to be the prime minister under the new government. Muqtada al-Sadr, our old friend, the quote-unquote radical cleric, he and his party and followers had quite a resurgence, particularly in the south of the country, and they've really made their reputation off of being opposed to the occupation and opposed to the U.S. military presence. And remember that there was quite a bit of talk by U.S. officials in the weeks leading up to the election of, well, the security situation is such that we may not be able to meet President Obama's deadline for withdrawing, and we may need to extend that deadline. And that didn't get much attention in the United States, but it created quite an uproar in Iraq, and that may have had an effect on the election returns. Similarly, you had Alawi, one of the interim prime ministers in the early days of the occupation, emerging as one of the leaders of the, by default almost, emerging as one of the leaders of the Sunni bloc. But he's not actually Sunni himself. He is Shiite. And so the Sunni bloc also is splintering. What this is a setup for is more sectarian strife. And as with the last election in 2006, a great deal of difficulty in forming a coalition government, and probably a great deal of paralysis within that government in Iraq. So democracy in Iraq still very much a work in progress, and probably going to have a lot more bumps in the road, as well as quite a bit more violence in the months and years to come.
That's so weird, because I didn't get that when I was watching the corporate news coverage of it this week. They were just talking about how the turnout there was better than in the U.S., and shouldn't we be envious of what we've created in Iraq?
I can explain why the turnout would be better than it is in the U.S., because in almost every country that has elections, the turnout is better than it is in the U.S. But, of course, as Maria mentioned, most of those countries have multiple parties, and therefore more candidates running who actually have a chance of winning, or at least, you know, especially in parliamentary systems where it's more of a proportion representation type of system, you have much more of a chance of having somebody in office who actually reflects your views and is willing to advocate for your views, as opposed to, you know, having a political system that's dominated by too big to fail banks.
All right, let's move on to Thailand.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit in the news about protests in Thailand, but the way it's been covered by the media here is sort of an us versus them thing between the current regime versus the former regime. Apparently, according to the U.S. media, the red shirts, as the protesters are called, support the former prime minister of Thailand, who was himself drummed out of office by the military in a military coup a couple of years ago because his government was corrupt, and that currently the red shirts support his return. Well, in fact, that's not why they're in the streets. If you read any of the quotes in the media, in particularly in the foreign media, where they actually interview some of the people in the streets in Thailand.
What a concept.
Yeah, what a concept. It would be nice if we did that here. What they're doing in the streets is because they're sick and tired of this seesawing back and forth between a military government that represents the elites and dominates society and a so-called civilian government run by the wealthy elites who manages to plunder the economy on behalf of the wealthy and not provide much in the way of services to the poor. The folks in the street are representative of the poor and the rural residents of Thailand who are sick and tired and want somebody to represent them. The current government is largely a military government with a civilian veneer that is supposed to eventually institute elections. While people in Thailand want elections now, they want a civilian government, and they want one that will be representative of them. And they're not willing to wait another 2 years, as they've been told that they must. So that's something to keep in mind as you're watching the demonstrations, which have lasted a full week now and may get re-energized this Saturday as more people turn out to the streets again, as they did last Sunday.
So why do you think it is that U.S. media coverage of this has been so fundamentally misleading?
Well, we like to shake our finger at the socialist governments in Asia, particularly China, and we tend to ignore those that are our economic allies, like in Thailand or in Indonesia, where the country is still largely run by the military with, as I said before, a civilian veneer to the government. But we don't necessarily do a lot of digging when we report about our allies and the fact that really they don't have a democratic government in places like Thailand and Indonesia and Malaysia and the Philippines, et cetera.
But isn't China our economic ally?
Well, that's actually mostly run by the military, too, actually.
Yes,
the military is by far the most powerful faction in the Chinese government.
In the Chinese government as well. But you see that a lot in reporting on China. They're also not only just an economic partner, they're also an economic rival, since U.S. companies have much more difficulty penetrating the Chinese market than they do the Thai market, for example.
All right, let's move on. Burma.
Yeah, in Burma, one of those places we like to shake our finger at because U.S. companies have difficulty penetrating the Burmese market. The military there is starting to sell off state assets in a huge cash grab in order to raise money because later this year the military is going to release a new constitution and hold elections. Of course, those elections will not include candidates from the party of Aung San Suu Kyi, who was the winner of the last round of elections that were held in Burma 20 years ago. She's never been allowed to take office, even though she was the winner of the presidential race there. The military in Burma is pretty much selling off everything. They're selling off everything from timber leases to gem and tin mines to farmland. They're selling off factories. They're even selling government buildings. It's a massive cash grab. And of course, they're selling these state assets to a lot of their friends and family members and cronies. So they're basically doing what General Suharto did in Indonesia when he got hold of the government and state assets. He said, well, I'm going to give these off to some of my friends and family members so that we can now transform ourselves from a socialist state to a state where we look more like, Thailand, where the military and the elite still run the country, but we've got this very very thin cover of a so-called civilian government.
All right, and very quickly, Afghanistan.
There were some stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post this week about Michael Furlong, a military employee who was running a group of civilian contractors in Afghanistan and Pakistan to collect intelligence that was then turned over to the military and military special forces to track down and assassinate members of the Taliban. Supposedly, this is illegal to use civilian contractors to run intelligence gathering operations, particularly if those operations are going to be used in military military maneuvers, and especially for assassination.
Yeah, you can't murder anybody in cold blood unless you're a member of a government.
Yes, unless you're an official member of the military. But interestingly enough, all these stories tend to say, oh, nobody really knows who was running the program. He did it on his own. It was something that he was given the money to do one thing, but he eventually drifted off into this intelligence gathering role. And I just don't buy that. I do not buy that for a second. It's not as if this guy went into the Pentagon, found a pile of cash and pocketed it and started running his own program.
Not that that doesn't happen.
That happens when the money's over in Iraq, for example, and they're passing it out of suitcases, but it doesn't happen here in the U.S. It seems to me that certainly someone had to know that he must have gotten the okay from higher ups in the military. He claims that the Joint Command told him to do this and run this program and gave him the okay. And I just want to point out at this point that all of the higher ups in Afghanistan from Army General McKiernan, who was the former top commander in Afghanistan, to the current commander, General McChrystal, have all had experience as the head of special operations, special forces. And that's what they like to do. And that's the way we're running the whole operation in Afghanistan. It's not a standard military operation. It's special forces, and a lot of it is stuff we don't know about, and this is just a piece of that.
Events.
Couple of events coming up tomorrow. Well, actually, yesterday was the 7th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and tomorrow there will be a march for that to commemorate that 7th anniversary and to call for, I don't know, into occupation, into war. That'd be a good thing. That'll be noon at Westlake Park in downtown Seattle, opposing the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war and all other wars, too. Then on Monday night at 7 o'clock, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility is hosting a forum, Cole's Assault on Human Health. And we were talking, of course, about coal-fired power plants and their mercury emissions. That's just one of the many different toxic examples of why they're a bad thing. That'll be at 7 o'clock Monday night at the REI flagship store at 222 Yale Avenue North, just north of downtown in what used to be called the Cascade neighborhood.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with the news and humor and events and, you know, cool stuff like that. Opinion, too, every now and then. You can find it where you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System. Or you can go online to our website at www.eatthestate.org. If you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, email us. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.